my whole life is basically in a way shaped by this book. This is my original copy. It's a book called Bard by Keith Taylor, who's an Australian writer. He's still around. He's a really nice guy. And I was camping. I was like 15 and I was camping by myself on an island off the coast of British Columbia. And I was just wandering around and I ended up like 4 hours early for a ferry to get to the next island. And I was just sitting there with nothing to do, but I'd found there was this, like those little spinning shells that you used to see in tourist places. There was this fantasy novel called Bard about an 8th century bard who wandered, went on adventures, traveling the world, like swinging a sword, you know, telling stories and I was like, that's it. That's the life. Like, that's what I want. My career is settled, you know, like a cross astronaut off the list. But yeah, there's never any jobs for bards in the Help Wanted. Like, you can't go on LinkedIn now and say, you know, I would like to be a bard.
What is up, everybody? You are listening to episode 98 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, MJ Kuhn. How's it going, MJ?
Hello, I'm lovely. How are you?
Shots fired, man. Shots fired.
I don't know. I'm in rare form tonight.
Oh, you're hyped up, baby. You're hyped up. If you want to support MJ and her little gun fingers, you can get The Blue Baby Among Thieves, her debut, and its big brother, the green baby, Thick Ass Thieves.
Pretty sure that's its little brother, but
no, Thick Ass Thieves.
Oh, it is thicker. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, it is thicker. It is, you know, literally thicker, and there's like 20 times more heists and a lot more ass kicking. So
it's true.
Read them both. It's a complete duology. You'll enjoy it.
There we go. Also, as of recently, you can also go pick up Adrian's book, Mushroom Blues, his debut.
Yeah.
If you like the weird and wonderful things like Jeff Vandermeer's work or True Detective, but you just wish to have more mushrooms, enter the fungal verse, y'all. The future is fungal. Check out Mushroom Blues.
Yeah. Get high and read.
Get high and read. I'm not necessarily condoning that, but live your dreams.
I am, sure. Also, the hardcover is out today when this episode airs. So you can go pick it up in hardcover or paperback or ebook and enjoy. As well, a quick note for listeners, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live. So check the links in the description to support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast app and subscribe to the FanFiatic YouTube channel where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And now, welcoming today's esteemed guest, Sebastian de Castell, the wickedly talented author of the Greatcoat series, Spellslinger, The Court of Shadows, and so much more. Welcome, Sebastian.
Hey, thanks for having me on. At last.
At last. You were one of my OG guests, but now we're doing one-on-one and I'm off your shit list and I'm very happy.
There you go. Although could I just do a correction for listeners on audio only that having seen MJ's book on the screen, the title is Thick as Thieves, not Sick Thick Ass Thieves. Which is what Adrian said like 3 times.
Yes.
No, but that's what I say every time. So return listeners will understand. New listeners will be thoroughly confused.
That's true. It is always funny because when I get new, like, you know, people tag me and stuff about the sequel and they say Thick Ass Thieves, I'm like, you came from the podcast.
I'm just envisioning these poor people going to their local fantasy and science fiction bookstore thing. Could you order Thick Ass Thieves for me?
I mean, in this age of spicy romanticy, you never know.
There could be. Yeah.
Actually, that's a good idea because it is.
That's like swashbuckling erotica, right there.
I mean,
I love it.
Huge market for it, I'm sure. Actually,
yeah. Well, thank you for the correction, Sebastian. But I'm never going to stop saying this. Sorry, not sorry. Before we dig deeper into the episode, a quick word from our sponsor. Novello is an exciting new publishing and reading platform whose goal is to be the go-to for all things writing and storytelling. Their platform offers an intuitive, user-friendly way for writers to create and share their awesome stories for readers to enjoy, all while maintaining total control over their stories. Everything from the content to cover art and pricing is all controlled by the story's author. Novello also offers social features such as message boards, direct messaging, and a news feed, where you can post updates to your followers. With future plans including support for comics and a marketplace for users to sell other writing-related services, the future of this platform is looking bright. And the best part? It's all available for free. No sign-up fees, no membership, just a growing library of epic tales. Sign up now to bask in the magic of books, where you can enjoy tales like Blackwater, an epic adventure by an award-winning author, or Limbo, The Door Above the Lake, a terrifying battle for survival. Whether you're a casual reader or a professional writer, Novello is the place for you. Visit them at novello.com. That's N-O-V-E-L-O.com. And now, enjoy the rest of this episode of SFF Addicts. So to start off, we'll do an introduction for listeners who aren't familiar with you and your work. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm Sebastian. I'm from Canada, Vancouver specifically. I write swashbuckling fantasy. My first series was called The Great Coats. It started with Traitor's Blade, which came out almost exactly a decade ago. I've been actually doing this for 10 years, it turns out.
Congratulations.
I know. It's like it's the longest coherent career I've ever had. Like, it's the only, when I first started, when I became a novelist, I remember everybody would talk about how, you know, oh, it's like such an uncertain business and stuff. But then, like, my first book contract was for 4 books. My second one was for 8. And so, you know, I was like, these are the most, like, consistently, this is the most stable career I've ever had. I'd never signed a contract that ran 4 years before.
Right.
So yeah, after the Great Coats came out, I was really lucky that it was a successful series. And then I sold an 8-book series to a young adult publisher by the name of Bonnier, where 6 of them were the Spellslinger series for people who like murderous squirrel cats and lots of weird magic. And then I wrote Malevolent 7, which was a book full of swear words that was never actually meant to be published. Like, I literally told my agent, like, who had asked to read it, like, don't try to sell this, nobody's gonna buy it, it's like incredibly rude, and I wrote it in a month, and then it's been my most successful book in the last few years.
It was so good though. I love the Malevolent 7.
it's such a bizarre series, and as it turns out, there's going to be 2 more books in this series. And yeah, I honestly, when I wrote it, I literally was just it was like 2020, it was February. I was in a really bad mood. I was sick of reading like about, you know, in the industry news about what's hot and what's not and the trends of this and that, and even fandom people talking about, well, this trope is outdated and this. And I just went, God, this stuff's like all just, it's killing my creative brain. I'm going to have to write something that's just like one giant, are we allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
One giant fuck you to, you know, everybody who has an opinion about fantasy. Yeah. So I was just writing it for myself. I was like, I'm going to spend the month writing a novel just for me. And then my agent asked to read it, and I said, sure. And then she read it and said, oh, I love this, I want to sell it. And I was like, no, you can't. And then she retired. And then as soon as my new agent came online, he said, your former agent told me all about this book, I want to read it. And I was like, oh, fine. I said, look, it's just mages wandering around like mercenary wizards blowing shit up. Yeah, it turns out there's a lot of like really juvenile people in this industry. Just loved it. And then by the time, you know, Joe Fletcher, the great editor, Joe Fletcher, who's my editor on the book, by the time, like, she had put me through my paces, all of a sudden, you know, the book had things to say, and, you know, it had a, as she put it, now it has a plot. Yeah. I've had a weird career.
It goes from a big fuck you to like, oh, people actually want to read this. And then Joe manages to infuse it with a little bit more substance.
With some structure.
Really, yeah.
Oh my God.
Most editors you work with, that, you know, they're usually, they don't even send you like comments or fixes. They send you queries. So it always comes out of like, what do you think about this? What would you think about maybe having that character not be terrible? just a suggestion. You know, it's a, whereas Joe with me is always just like redlining whatever she wants. Like, this is terrible. Love this it. Is, you know, but yeah, I just adore working with her. She's, you know, completely sort of shaped, you know, the early part of my career and a lot of me as a writer. So.
Awesome. That's amazing. I actually really, really prefer like redline that shit. Give me some.
Yeah, right? Don't really sugarcoat it. Just like, bam, yeah, tell me what you yeah, want and then yeah, we'll make it happen.
Don't ask me questions. I already put enough like energy into this thing. I don't want to think about it anymore.
I know. Yeah. Give it to me straight. I can take yeah. it and then I'll hate you quietly forever.
And then I'll write another fuck you book. Yeah, maybe to you specifically.
Right. Specifically targeted towards you. Oh my gosh. Oh, well, I think we got a great, like, I mean, you've had a pretty varied career in terms of the books that you have. You have a ton of them back there. Look at them all lined up, everyone watching on video. But I want to know your origin story before 2014. So we always like to look into, you know, your nerdy origin stories. Do you remember the book, movie, game, show, whatever it was in childhood that sparked your love for the genre?
Yeah, you know, the genre, like my whole life is basically in a way shaped by this book. This is my original copy. It's a book called Bard by Keith Taylor, who's an Australian writer. He's still around. He's a really nice guy. And I was camping, I was like 15 and I was camping by myself on an island off the coast of British Columbia. And I was just wandering around and I ended up like 4 hours early for a ferry to get to the next island. And I was just sitting there with nothing to do, but I'd found there was this, like those little spinning shells that you used to see in tourist places. There was this fantasy novel called Bard about an 8th century bard who wandered, went on adventures, traveling the world, like swinging a sword, you know, telling stories and I was like, that's it. That's the life. Like, that's what I want. My career is settled, you know, like a cross astronaut off the list. But yeah, there's never any jobs for bards in the Help Wanted. Like, you can't go on LinkedIn now and say, you know, I would like to be a bard. And so I ended up doing like all different kinds of careers over the course of like a couple of decades of, you know, I taught, I worked as a project manager, but I also worked as an actor. I choreographed sword fights for the stage. I was in a, you know, traveling, you know, rock band for a few years, just going through every small town on the planet, playing Brown Eyed Girl three times a night. And, took up fencing, which is what got me into the stage combat stuff. And so I kind of became a bard in the aggregate. And then finally, like that all manifested in being a storyteller. And so, yeah, I get to travel the world and, you know, my books have been translated into 15 languages now. And, every once in a while I swing a sword. So it all worked out.
Amazing.
Every once yeah. in a while. Every once you know, in a while. I love how you manifested your inner bard.
Yeah, right. Because,
you know, like talking to you and so many other authors that I've talked to, I love like the eclectic nature of a person's accumulative life that got them to the point of like, I'm gonna be an author, you know? Or like all the shit that you do before, how that influences you step by step. And gives you that life experience that you can then pull into your work. And you like reading your stuff, like I know about your background and I know that you have included a lot of your experiences in your work, obviously incorporating it in a very natural way. But like hearing your stories and then reading your stories, I'm like, oh fuck yes, this is good. This is good.
I mean, that's the thing. That's like the great thing about writing, right? That's one of the reasons why I always say like everybody who wants to write a novel should write a novel, because it is in part like the accumulation of your experiences. It's like every weird thought you ever had, every heartbreak you've ever felt, every struggle you've ever had, like it all kind of manifests inside your story. Even if what you're writing about is like, you know, I don't write about sparkly vampires, but you know, when someone writes about sparkly vampires, like, you know, they're often imbuing them with like, that's why those characters can actually still be compelling. Like, how many more books about dragons do we need? Well, we can have an infinite amount because everybody's dragon is infused with something that they've kind of experienced. And I often talk about this now, like the really cool thing I'm discovering, you know, I've had 16 novels published and I'm still kind of figuring out what it means creatively. But one of the things I've discovered is that, like, the great thing about the process of writing a novel is it's a process of discovering the answer to a question that you don't know how to answer any other way. My sister's an academic, and when I was younger, I was like, I saw her office at a university, and I was like, this looks great. I want to be a university professor because that looks like the life for me. And she had sort of said, look, there's only one good reason to get a PhD. You get a PhD because there's a question you desperately want to answer and nobody else has ever answered it before. And I was thinking about that recently because, you know, whenever I finish a novel, including Malevolent 7, which, you know, I wasn't even trying to, I was almost trying the opposite. I was trying, like, I'm not putting any themes or, you know, in this book. And then, like, you can't help it. And by the end, it became a novel where I realized, like, I was writing about, you know, the problem that we're separating each other into good people and bad people all the time. Like, we've defined, like, a bad person is anyone who ever does something bad. And a good person is someone who's never been caught doing anything bad. You know, and I was like, well, what happens when, you know, when we need people who we've defined as bad? Like, what happens when you've basically, you know, canceled you can cancel your local firefighters, but you still need them to put out the fire. And if people start feeling like, you know what, you know, the world's told me I'm a piece of crap, I don't have any obligation to it, then we're in a lot of trouble because we kind of actually need all of each other when we're facing, like, the really big challenges, and we've got so many big challenges. So it was just that for me. It was like exploring that. And so I realized, like, that's what happens when, that's one of the privileges of writing a novel, is you go, hey, there's this thing. I don't even know how to articulate what it is. I'm not even conscious of what it is, but I start writing a book about swashbuckling actors in a, you know, enchanted theater. And all of a sudden, like, you start to kind of find it. And so, yeah, it's that's the most amazing thing. So anybody who's listening and wants to write a novel and thinks you're not qualified or something, you are, and you've probably got something really interesting to discover. So do it.
Yeah. And even if you write it, doesn't mean you have to publish it, you know?
No.
I think there is, like, such a catharsis to just writing something and finishing it. And one of my friends always puts it really well. Think about how many people say they want to write a novel and never do. If you write a novel and you finish it, even if it doesn't get published, even if you don't revise it, even if you don't put it out into the world, you are in
you're like the top a club. 1% of, yeah. As a writer, it sounds weird, but, like, I didn't tell anyone I was writing until I got my first book deal.
I like how you phrased it.
I know, but, like, I didn't want to tell anyone because, like, what if I didn't succeed? Whatever.
Right.
But, like, pretty much everyone I told is like, oh, you know, I'm going to write a novel someday when I have the time. And it's like, maybe you should if you want to, but will you, right? So it's like, I think everybody wants to, but it's, you know, if you have the stick-to-itiveness and the stubbornness to actually barf the thing out.
I've been asked to do talks for, you know, high school students, like in English lit classes or writing classes. And it's funny because I'll talk to the teachers beforehand and they'll say, and I'll be like, you know, so tell me about the students. And they're like, well, you know, like, you know how, like, before every kid thought they were going to be a novelist, you know, now none of them think that. They think there's no point. They'll never earn a living. They'll never succeed because we've kind of, like, told everybody that, you know, that it's just like a field where you can't succeed anymore. And so I always try to sort of, I always say, look, there's four reasons why you should write a novel that have nothing to do with making money and nothing to do with a hobby. It's like, number one is it makes you smarter. And it's actually really hard to find things in the world that makes you smarter. But when you write a novel, you are functionally stretching parts of your brain because it's so hard to hold a whole novel in there at once. And it's the same as, like, you know, when people, you know, train to run their first marathon, only, like, nobody goes, I'm only going to run my first marathon if I'm going to win. You don't do that. You run a marathon so you can change your body into a body that can run marathons. And when you write a novel, you change your mind into a mind that can hold all that stuff together. And so, like, I felt like after I finished my first novel that, you know, I was like, my brain is just shaped differently. There's just, like, more capacity. And the second thing is it actually makes you so much more confident. I always tell people, like, write a novel, you'll get promoted at work. Cause I remember, like, I was working at Vancouver Film School and, you know, where I almost never felt qualified for anything. And I was, you know, up for a possible higher position. And I remember just going, well, just tell me what it is you guys need to fix. Cause, you know, nobody, you know, people don't promote people for the sake of promoting. They do it because they have problems that need to be solved. And I was like, there's no problem that they can put in front of me that's harder than writing a novel. You know, like whatever it is, I think I can handle it. And so I ended up being the director of strategic program development. I was on the executive and I loved it. And there was a wonderful, wonderful school to work for. But that's the second thing. The third thing I would say is it makes you more interesting. Like, you know, if you were walking down the street and Zeus like appeared in front of you and said, behold, I am Zeus. I will now tell you the future. Not that Zeus usually does that, but no matter what you ever do, your entire life, you're going to be a gas station attendant. There's nothing you can do that's going to change that, right? And I always say, imagine if that happened to you. Now, do you want to be a gas station attendant when you go to a party and people say, what do you do? And you say, I'm a gas station attendant, but it's nice because I get to write my novels when I'm there, right? Or do you want to be the person who says, I'm a gas station attendant, I play a lot of video games? Like, you know what I mean? Like it makes you more interesting and it makes other people more interesting to you. Like when I used to be the kind of person who would really just write people off when they rubbed me the wrong way. You know, I'd hear somebody gossiping and but once you start writing novels, you start thinking of characters and you start finding depth and you realize when you hear someone say something that annoys you or express an opinion that offends you or something, and seems like they're just awful people, you realize like there's all kinds of reasons for that. And you're like, maybe I want to find out more about this person. So those are four things that are kind of life-changing, or they were life-changing for me that had nothing to do with ever getting a book deal.
Yeah. Cause it's like, looking at the world through the lens of story makes you understand, like, I'm going to try and understand better the complexities of human nature. And if that person's annoying me, there's story tension there. It's my story tension because I'm annoyed by that person, but how can you kind of like deconstruct that and figure out why that's happening? And then when you're writing characters, it works for this character to annoy that character for the purpose of the story. And you can kind of pull on all those experiences.
Yeah. Well, and it forces you to get inside other people's heads, right? Makes you more empathetic.
You mentioned earlier traveling. And I think traveling is another one of those things that really helps to expand your brain, hearing other languages, learning other languages, seeing other places, other cultures. How has your travel influenced your work? And are there any locations that have inspired like specific locales or cultures in your fictional worlds?
Yeah, I've been really lucky. My wife and I both love to travel. And so we've done a ton of traveling. And it's exactly as you say, like traveling is one of the other things. Like after you're 18, there's very few ways to actually like increase your IQ. And university's one, but traveling's another. And the reason I always bring up writing is not everybody like either financially or temperamentally, you know, can do lots of traveling. But those people who feel uncomfortable doing that or can't afford to, you know, can actually write a novel. But traveling always, I think more than anything, it's meeting people who lead different lives and see the world through a very different lens. And you know how people will say, you know, everywhere you go, people are all the same. And if you travel a lot, you know, that's not true. Right. There's places where people both lead very different lives, but have very different internal lives as well. And so you sort of go, well, they're experiencing the world in a way that's so different, just purely in the sense of the lens through which they see it. And there are, and then through that, you find the commonalities, right? You start to see those like kind of more fundamental things about being a human being. And you can kind of appreciate both. You can appreciate the commonalities that you share, but you can also appreciate those differences. And as you mentioned, you brought up languages, which is, you know, when you realize, you know, when you're learning like another language and you realize like the things that are very difficult to say from one language to another, you know, there'll be things that are very, very easy to express in French, but you can't really, they're very difficult to express in English and vice versa. You realize how much language shapes thought, And so language always plays a big role for me, and those ideas play a big role for me. You know, one of my favorite series to write is the Argosy series with the character Farius Parfax from the, who was first appeared in the Spellslinger books. And she's what's called an Argosy. And these are these, like, there were these wandering gambler philosophers, right? And they have this whole kind of weird philosophy. It's very individualistic, but it's very built on like finding your own path and all those kind of things. And figuring out how to deal with other human beings in like the four different ways you can deal with other human beings in any given situation. And a lot of that comes from traveling, right? Where you realize, like, you know, 90% of the time you know, in the Argosy terms, you follow the way of water. You just want to flow through a place. You don't want to take anything. You don't want to leave anything behind. You don't want to create any problems for anybody else. And, you know, but sometimes you kind of have to follow the clues to something. You realize that there's, and so the, you know, in the Argosy books, it's called like the way of wind, right? You follow the way of wind. I'm going to actually follow these clues to something that, that might be important. And then there's like the way of thunder, which is like literally if you have to do something, if there's going to be conflict and you can't avoid it, you have to do it fast and sudden, and you know, and you can't apologize. You know, it's like never do anything bad unless there is no possible other alternative. And if there's no other possible alternative, you must be, you know, like thunder, just quick. And then the way of stone, which is like those times where you have to actually like stand firm no matter what, you know, and so a lot of those kind of that notion, that Argosy notion of what they call the four ways, the way of water, wind, thunder, and stone, like that comes from the experience of traveling, because when you're traveling, those things are, their life is both more uncertain, but there's also greater clarity in any, you know, of the moment. You know, you're so much in the moment. So it's all kind of plays into it. It's less a matter of traveling and then applying settings. You know, this, you know, it's, you know, traveling to Egypt and going, oh, okay, I'm going to make this feel like Egypt, because Egypt doesn't feel like Egypt. You know what I mean? Like the pyramids have almost nothing to do with the lives of, you know, almost all Egyptians.
Right.
You know, it's mostly, you know, other people who wouldn't recognize an ancient Egyptian. Like they're different people and they have their own.
It wouldn't even resonate with like Cleopatra, because Cleopatra was closer to today than she was to the building of the pyramids. So it's like such a nebulous kind of.
Yeah.
Notion of like,
yeah,
things are permanent over all of history, right?
Yeah. And so if you keep trying to impose, it's an interesting, I tend to think of it as a very North American and sometimes British phenomenon of trying to impose a nation's past upon its present. You know, you go to Egypt and you expect it to be like ancient Egypt, and you only pay attention to the things that you've seen in, you know, the mummy. So you can absolutely miss, you know, the actual culture of Egypt that exists today. That's, you know, and I haven't been for 20 years or so, so I shouldn't speak about Egypt, but even France is the same. If you go to France and you keep trying to imagine La Belle Époque, you know, you're doing such a disservice to yourself, but also to the people that live there, of trying to impose upon, no, this is, you know, I'm from North America, like where things have advanced, we're in the 21st, but you're supposed to be in the 19th century.
You're supposed to be self-contained in this like certain epoch that I idealize.
Bubble.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing. When traveling is inspiring parts of your writing, you sort of keep trying to think of like those imagined pasts of a place, but then the people that you meet contradict it so much. And they're the ones that end up informing what you're writing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we talked a little bit about language, and I want to dive into the language in the text of the books, because one of the things you're known for, and one of the things I know as a reader I definitely love in your books, is the witty dialogue between the characters and the humor. We got to talk about the humor a little bit. You can't talk about your books without talking about humor. In your opinion, what is the role of humor in how you express your characters? Like, how does that inform the character? How do you use humor to convey the character better to your audience?
Well, so for me, humor, so because I connect a lot with the sort of swashbuckling literature and that kind of notion. Like, I come almost more out of the picaresque tradition than the fantasy tradition, even though everything I write is ostensibly fantasy. But it's, you can see more of what I do inside, like, Scaramouche by Raphael Sabatini than you will in J.R.R. Tolkien, in The Lord of the Rings, for example. And humor plays a very important role in swashbuckling, because humor is an act of defiance in swashbuckling stories, right? You don't tell a joke for the sake of getting a laugh. You tell a joke as an act of defiance against, what seem like insurmountable odds. And with the Greatcoats especially, they're constantly in these fairly dire circumstances, and things can get very dark. And so that's banter. Banter is both a way of expressing, of like sharing with other people, like, yes, I'm defying what we're dealing with, right? I refuse to let this horrible circumstance, I'm not going to mirror it. I'm going to oppose it. And humor is part of how you oppose it. But banter specifically, which I kind of love, is also a way by which people, and in the case of books, characters, express the sense of connection, right? Like, I wouldn't banter with you. Like, before the show, we were bantering a little bit, because Adrian like consistently avoided having me on his shows.
and Sebastian's never going to let it go.
No, exactly.
Even if you're here, and you're still not
too
letting
late.
It go.
Doesn't matter. It's too little, too late, baby.
Exactly. But here's the thing. Just even that becomes a kind of shared language, right? So, that if we were in a situation where conflict had, where maybe we had reasons to be angry with one another, that, you stepped on my foot or something. And I was like, God damn it. I should have known that you'd do this. You'd never wanted me on your show anyway, right? You would know from that like bit of stupidity that I'm saying it's okay. Right.
Yeah.
And so I like the use of humor as an act of defiance. And I like the use of banter as a way of expressing a shared language. And that was the secret sauce of Falchio Kestenbrasti and the Greatcoats, which I honestly, if I tried to do it intentionally, I don't think I have the skill to. I was kind of lucky that I found that. But because like right away in those books, you see that connection. And when they speak to each other, you kind of sense that whatever they're saying is part of a shared language. And that part of that for me came from, I was a musician for a long time. And, when you're in a band, there's a weird process where, thank goodness there was no social media like when I was on the road in bands. Because when you're in the green room backstage, like when you're in a band, when you go out on stage, you have to be a certain thing for the audience, and a lot of the time that means like, not saying horrible, horrible things in the mic. And so backstage, for whatever reason, all the main band I was in, we would just say the most horrible things imaginable. Like, it was a nonstop festival of things for which one could deservedly be canceled. Because you're telling jokes to each other. There's a famous joke called The Aristocrats, right? Which I think, Adrian, you said you were going to tell your version of The Aristocrats on this show, right?
No.
I'm not familiar with this joke.
Don't check it out now, Adrian. Come on, Adrian. No. MJ doesn't know. The Aristocrats is a famous joke comedians tell to each other. And where it's basically just like a guy walks into an entertainment agent's office and says like, I want you to be my agent. And he says, well, what kind of act do you have? He said, oh, it's a family show. And anybody who's ever heard The Aristocrats, or there was a great documentary about it, is probably cringing right now because they're terrified I'm actually going to go through with it. But basically what happens is 99% of the joke is just someone describing the act. And it's the most horrifyingly offensive thing you can imagine. And they just go on forever describing this horrific family act on stage. And then the guy goes, oh my God, what do you call that? And the punchline of the joke, which everybody knows, so it's not is always The Aristocrats. And so it doesn't make any sense why it's funny, except that it's often hilarious. And so when I was writing Play of Shadows, which is the latest book, which is set in a theater and there's a theater troupe, I invented something called The Rampant Lord, which, because I wanted a thing that was like something like The Aristocrats, where it's a joke that that actors tell each other in a desperate bid to show how horrible they can seem. Like they're supposed to play the part, tell the story of this lord who was quite lusty. And so it's just, how gross can you make it? And so when I was writing Play of Shadows, there's a moment where there's this huge, this huge problem, and there's these thugs and militias that are about to take over the stage, and they need to distract everybody while the others are trying to get ready to sort of deal with the problem. And so they make one of the actors go out and do the rampant lord. And so he has to like be so horrifyingly offensive that actually the people coming to kill them, will actually be standing there watching in despair at this. I love stuff like that. So humor can serve so many different purposes in our own lives. And so I always feel like it needs to serve, a purpose inside a story, it's not just a joke for a joke's sake. It's like, why is a character telling a joke and what is it supposed to do?
Yeah. But the thing about shared language though, this is something that like MJ, you've done really well. Sebastian, you've done really well. Nick Eames, he who shall not be named, he does really well. The notion of like humor being a shared language within a found family, I think is especially evocative. Like that kind of banter that you get between different characters who didn't necessarily, be born into each other's lives. It's like they chose each other, they found each other. And humor being one of the shared languages that they have, I think really amplifies the effect of, in the case of your novels, like strong friendships and very engaging found family dynamics. So how, like building on top of that humor kind of angle, how do you approach building the relationships of a found family? Or what is your advice for building a believable found family? One that isn't like annoying and disjointed, but instead feels connected and realistic.
Or realistically disjointed.
Or realistically disjointed.
There you go.
Which is just a regular family. It's funny because I was doing an interview years ago, and where the interviewer was a really lovely guy, had it was for a radio show, and he'd like really read the books. He'd read a lot into the books, and he started saying, Falcio in Traitor's Blade, his father left when he was a kid, and just sort of disappeared. And then,
did he psychoanalyze your character?
Oh yeah, no. And he went, Kellen's father, is kind of the villain of his life. And some, but you lost your father when you were young. So how are these things related? And I remember thinking, oh my God, that sounds like a really intelligent question. And I have no intelligent answer for it. Yeah. But it's true. Like I find, in almost all my series, it's found family is kind of the key, like Falcio Keston Brasti. And then in Spellslinger, Kellen and Rikus, his ostensible, the squirrel cat, that's his ostensible business partner, and Farius Parfax, who's his mentor. Like they form this sort of trio. And even Malevolent Seven, like is basically a found family sort of story. And so I love those stories, but the way that I get to it is very different because I'm always writing from the standpoint of a single character, right? So I've literally, Crucible of Chaos is the first novel of mine out of 16 novels that is not in first person. And even that is still told exclusively from Estivar's perspective. So the way that I tend to build a cast of characters. And in fact, the way I build a world is I start from one character who is my main character. And then I build the cast out of the people that most challenge them. So with Falcio Keston Brasti, originally because it was Falcio's perspective, I wanted Kest to be like the greatest swords in the world because that way Falcio would never be as good as him and would always have to carry that. And I wanted Brasti to be better looking and more charming because when you're with a group of friends and you're like, oh my God, everybody is better than me at something. Like I am the slightly pathetic C-minus average of this group.
But the thing is that the people who are thinking that are neglecting the one thing that the other people think, oh, fuck him, he does that better than me.
Exactly. Which was the key is that if you can write, I remember a friend of mine, a really great writer, Eric Torin, who's helped me with virtually all my books over my career. He said that when he'd read, Traitor's Blade, he said like, it's amazing. Like you've created a story where the main character is literally never described, not even once, not his hair color, nothing. Right. And yet I can almost see him, but it's like you've created this Falchio shaped hole inside the book the whole way through. And it's kind of true because Falchio is always basically hiding stuff from you, is never really telling you the full story, but everybody else is kind of through their reactions is kind of telling you the other side of that story. One of my favorite scenes to write was in Night Shadow, which is the second book in that series. And it opens with Falchio. He's been poisoned. And so he's suffering this paralysis. And there's this whole sort of strange thing going on, this political thing going on in the background. And so he's lying there. So he can hear everything that Kest and Brasti are saying. But he can't talk and he can't do anything. And so the two of them are like trying to solve, like, what's this mystery that's going on? And they're sort of like, I don't know, that's not my job. That's Falchio's job. Well, what would Falchio do? Well, he'd give a really long speech about something and then he'd kind of probably fall over his sword and then trip on the answer. And I'm like, well, let's try that. And so Falchio is like getting so incredibly frustrated, but that's the beauty of it is that when you construct your characters from the standpoint of who's going to most challenge my character, you end up with that sense, not just of dimensionality of the characters having multiple dimensions to them, but of the relationship having dimensions to it. And that's the most important thing. And the same thing was true in Spellslinger. Like Kellen on his own would be like an annoying, like, it's funny how many people will come up to me and go, oh, Spellslinger is my favorite series. I love that, blah, blah, blah. And then they'll go, yeah. And Kellen's so annoying, like, he's the main character. Like, he's the narrator. He's, but they love him because they see him through the eyes of Farius and Rikus. That was a trio that basically I built, a Freudian, the Freudian trio, psychological trio from, right? So Kellen's like the ego, right? He's like trying to, make decisions. He's trying to act. Rikus is the id. Like, Rikus either wants to steal something, kill it, or sleep with it. And he like doesn't care what anybody thinks, right? And then Farius is sort of like the superego. She's like that voice that says, why are you doing the things that you're doing, right? And those characters exist, like, at first, again, because you ask, like, okay, what's your method? And so for me, it's that I start by challenging my main character and I create other characters around them to challenge them. And then somehow, and I don't know why, always becomes a sort of a found family.
Yeah, well, because it makes sense, though, because you're weaving them all together right from the point of the character's inception. And you mentioned that you kind of do that with World as well, that it kind of is... That's funny. I had not noticed that they're all first person, like the books I've read of yours. So everything literally in the first person ones is filtered through the eyes of the character. But even so, when it's close third person, what is your approach to world building? Do you start literally when you do your process with a character and the world comes from their perception of it? Or do you do your world building separately?
So first of all, I don't have a process for writing a novel, which is a weird thing because I've had 16 published and I probably have like 8 that I've just written for their own sake, because sometimes I'll just go, I'm going to write a novel for me this month. Or, I have 3 mystery novels that
3 for them, 1 for me.
It's sort of like, it's funny because when you hit with writing, people often hit the thing where like, oh my God, like it's taking so much time to write a book and blah, blah, blah. And you would think that like writing another book is going to make that even harder. Like you're splitting your time, but sometimes I write another book just to clear my sort of creative pathways. I apologize for anyone listening. My cat has decided there's this cool thing to do, which is he picks up one of his toys and just holds it in his mouth and yowls for no reason.
I was wondering what that sound was.
Yeah, I was so love it. I thought it might be coming from your side, Adrian, with your kids, but nope, it's a cat. No,
it's Peluche, who is the model for Rikus. And yeah, he will do this like every time my wife and I go to bed at night, he does this thing now where he just starts doing that. And most recently he's figured out that it's a really cool thing to do when I'm on, when I'm doing interviews.
I love it. He just wants to be included.
Yeah.
He doesn't. He's standing there. He's staring at me with a toy bird in his mouth, yowling for no reason. And at some point he's going to, there, he dropped it. And now he'll come over.
Because he got your attention. That's what he wanted.
Yeah. And then he does a different meow that's like,
oh,
it's
smiley. Oh, I see his little tail. Oh my God. I love it.
All right. Cat interlude. Going on TV. There.
We love the animal interlude.
Oh,
I know. Yes. He's an excessively handsome cat, but he's also a complete jerk.
You're a bad roommate.
No, so Dean Wesley Smith says something that I think is really interesting, which is like, and I think it's him. I'm not sure. Maybe he stole it from somewhere else, and then I stole it from him. But he says you start with a character in a dark cave, and you can't see anything, and you just give him a flashlight, and the only world that you build is whatever's in the beam of the flashlight. And I try to do that most of the time because I find that the thing about writing fantasy, like the main reason for me to write fantasy as opposed to, I don't know, historical adventure or something else or modern contemporary crime novels or something, is that with fantasy, you can, if there's a theme that you just subconsciously want to explore, but you're setting your book in our world or a historical period, you have to kind of mess with stuff to make that theme feel manifest in that world. Like it's very difficult to write like the tough, gritty streets of Vancouver. Some people have done it, but I don't know how to do it very well. Whereas a fantasy world, you can go, I'm really interested in the theme of like corruption, and you can make the physics of that world corrupt if you want. Right. You can, that one of the things I did with like Traitor's Blade, like that's what it's, with the greatcoats, I wanted to write about this notion of just how much people will accept and in fact start to validate corruption over idealism, because idealism will start to feel so enraging to them for its failures, right? How come if you've got this perfect philosophical ideal of how things should be, how come you keep failing at it? How come the world is terrible? So now I'm going to listen to the people who I know are corrupt, who I know are lying to me, but at least they're winning. And so I made it so that, for example, magic in the world of the greatcoats is this thing that only really rich people ever have, right? Like they, because in our world, if there were people who could do real magic, they would just get bought up by, billionaires and gangsters, and that would be it. The rest of us aren't going to get it, right? And so I like being able to build a world that way. So with the greatcoats, I start with Falcio, who's a character who, when he was a kid, all he wanted to do was live that heroic ideal. And his model for that was the greatcoats, these itinerant justices who traveled, on judicial circuits and heard cases and tried to make the world a little bit more fair. And then I went like, now I'm going to build a world where that totally doesn't work. What happens when when it turns out that the thing you believe in does not work? Like I'm an absolutely dedicated kind of classical liberal humanist, right? Like I believe that to my core. Nobody has shown me a philosophy that I think is better than humanism, that is better than a Western social democracy politically, right? But I live in a world where sometimes it looks like that doesn't work, right? And what happens if it turns out that actually we've been wrong all this time, right? What if it turns out that actually the way you can do the most good for the most people is having a strongman dictator, which is something that people are starting to believe. And so with fantasy, you can explore that in a way that you don't, it doesn't feel like you're giving a propagandist view. Like if I write that story in a contemporary setting, it's just going to look like I'm crapping on Donald Trump or something, right? Which is just not, it's just not my job as a novelist. Like it's not what I'm out there to do. Like I don't feel like I need to write anti Donald Trump propaganda. Like, it's just not, I don't think I would be serving anybody particularly well, but in a fantasy setting, I can explore those things. And by not tying them to particular places, times, or people in our world, I can do a better job with it. I can explore that and challenge myself and challenge the reader. And the wonderful thing about it, especially with fantasy, is you don't have to do it in a blunt, explicit way. Like, you know, I always joke that like there's a book I'm writing now, which is the most difficult book I've ever attempted. It's called Our Lady of Blades. It's the second book in the Court of Shadows series. And this thing is just, it's going to be my masterpiece. It's so intricate and complicated and it's like set in two timelines and there's all these like false memories and all this. It's like Memento meets the Count of Monte Cristo. And I joke that like, you know, and when it comes out, people, you know, reviewers are going to say, it's a nice lighthearted fantasy that doesn't take itself too seriously. because that's the thing, right? You can write stuff where you're like, and it's full of all these themes and all this. Oh my God, I discovered the answer to this thing that I've never understood. I was even questioning. And then huge swaths of people can read it and go, oh yeah, it's a nice light fantasy that it doesn't take itself seriously.
Yeah, I always feel like some of it gets through though, right? Like I always love fantasy because of you can explore those kind of headier themes.
Exactly.
The themes that, like you said, would look propagandist or like preachy or whatever if you set them in a different setting. But you can kind of just like by taking it out of a world that looks like ours and putting it, you know, the situation and the challenges and the core of the issue in the hands of people that are nothing like your neighbors, right? I do feel like it opens people's minds a little bit, even if it is a nice, lighthearted fantasy.
No, exactly. No, that's the beauty of it. And yeah, when I'm at conventions and book signings and stuff, and people come up to me, it's funny because I can almost always tell when someone's coming up to talk to me, where they're one of the people who just totally read the book the way that I read the book, because right. You know they're kind of like. Tongue-tied, and they're just not, and they know there's not enough time to express what they want to express, so I'm off going, it's okay, I feel that way too.
Like, I get you.
but you know, that's, you know, when you there's so many, you know, Star Trek, that's, you know, whatever remembers the original series for, right? It used science fiction to tackle issues that people weren't comfortable seeing on television, or, you know, Bugs Bunny, which if you really understand it, is a giant Ayn Randian objectivist rant. Yeah. It's about how, like, you know, how society is trying to hold back the rabbit. No, I'm kidding.
It's pretty insane how cartoons were like the most politically subtle social commentaries for the most part of like the 20th century at the very least. But you brought up book two in Court of Shadows. I want to talk a bit more about this series because this is your newest series. It starts with Play of Shadows, but it also includes the standalone prelude, prequel, Crucible of Chaos. What can you tell us about this series, but also why you decided to return again to the world of the Greatcoats and why the Greatcoats universe that you established with your first series has persisted over time in your mind?
Sure. Well, I'll answer the last question first, which is because the answer is money. So that's moving on.
Familiarity.
No. Yeah, it was interesting. So when I finished Tyrant's Throne, so the Greatcoats ended up being a really popular series for Quirkus. And so they wanted another series. And I said, like, but there's nowhere I can take Falkio right now. Like, I beat that guy up as much as one can beat someone. Like, his arc is complete. That's true. And so we were looking at, but one of the things I hadn't done in that world, like the funny thing is I introduced the Greatcoats as, you know, hey, instead of knights, because I hate knights, Miles Cameron and I always love like wrestling about knights.
He would be the best person to argue about knights with.
He still loves like knighthood and the knightly ideals. And I'm just always like, yeah, that was all crap made up by like, you know, priests working castles to try to convince knights to stop butchering everyone, you know, by telling stories of like how knights had these knightly ideals that they were merciful and stuff, because they just kind of hoped that maybe the knights would start to aspire to that instead of being the, you know, miserable biker gangs that they actually were. Thank God Chris was not on this podcast, so you can't
counter me with actual facts. I'm gonna send him a link with a timestamp and everything.
Yeah, he's got a really bad 7. Yeah, he's quite impolite about those debates, because he will start like bringing in actual historical facts, which I don't think is fair play.
I think we're having a fictional debate, Miles. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. But But one of the things that I realized is I created, you know, you're introduced to the great coats. It's like, oh yeah, they're traveling judges who have to duel sometimes to enforce their verdict. And they wear these amazing coats and, you know, that have like all these secret pockets and tools and traps and weapons and stuff so that they can survive and kind of anywhere they go. And then I go, yeah, but we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about it after it's all fallen apart. And like, you know, you're never going to get that part. And so I wanted to be able to kind of, so the thing that doesn't get explored in the first four books as much is just literally like all of those things, the different orders, the Bardati and the great coats and how does that work and getting to be more intimate with it because it was such a big story fundamentally, you know, it's about like, what kind of country is that place going to be? You know, by necessity, I couldn't like diverge into all of those little subtleties without ending up writing those, you know, 300,000 word tomes that where like the action stops for, you know, 200 pages while you describe like the silverware at a party. And I'm not good at that. Like other people can do it really well, but I you know, I kind of need the story to move along. And so, so with Court of Shadows, it's like, okay, well, I want to explore different characters and that are in different parts of this country that are discovering like this hidden threat that's been there for a long time that nobody's realized and that you can't see for yourself. Like you can't, I'm interested in things that you can't understand from one point of view, right? Like phenomena, you know, this is a bad analogy, but it's sort of at least kind of has some utility. When you think of like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and I'm worse at science than I am at like facts generally. So I'm going to butcher it right here, but the notion that, you know, you can measure something's velocity or its location, but not both, right? When you're dealing at like a subatomic level. And again, anybody mm-hmm. who passed, physics 11, I apologize for for this, but you get the point.
We're not here for the physics.
Okay. Exactly. No, but, I'm doing this sci-fi novel with Christy Cherish, a friend of mine who's a really good writer, and she is a scientist. And it's so funny because when we write, we actually write like on a video call on a shared Google Doc live, cool. rather than passing chapters back and forth. Nice. And it's so funny because the number of times I'm like, okay, well, there's this kind of this thing happens in the hallway, and then oh, this person gets hit, and so they slump down to the floor, and she has to remind me like they're on a spaceship in zero gravity, like you don't slump down to the floor. That doesn't, yeah. So that's how bad I am with science. And I'm like, what if the floor is magnetic? Just that's not how magnetism works.
What if they just swallow a bunch of magnets?
Exactly.
All the time.
Like, I know. Yeah, I was literally going to go. All their clothes are magnetic.
Oh my God.
But it's being able to just kind of delve into things that that you can't, that one person can't see. So much of I see so much in fantasy where, you know, one person sees all, right? Or one character experiences the crux of what's causing a war. Or how a war unfolds. And that's not really how the world works. You can't see most complicated things by yourself. Human beings need other human beings to form a brain that is capable of comprehending these big complicated things. And so that's why I wanted, with each book is introducing another hero in the story. So Play of Shadows is Damlas Shadamantane, who is kind of an actor, one of these, what they call veristores. He doesn't intend to be, but he ends up discovering he's a veristore, which is these actors who, when they play a historical character on stage, can actually channel the spirits of the original historical figure. In his case, unfortunately for him, he channels the spirit of the country's most notorious murderer, and ends up revealing a secret that turns like the city on its head. And so I like that. Like there's one, you know, and he's discovering a lie, 100-year-old lie that he can't see what it's going to mean. But then when you read Our Lady of Blades, which is set in Rijou, which is the most corrupt city in Tristia, set in the court of Blades, which is, you know, a dueling court, and you start to find out like what's happening there, you know, Lady Consequence is the alias of the main character. She's seeing one piece of it, but she can't see all of it either. Only the reader, when the reader's reading all of these different books, these different characters, can start to see what none of them can see. And so I was kind of interested in doing that. And because it also allowed me to get a little bit more intimate with this world and all the fun, interesting things that I had to, you know, that I couldn't delve into as deeply with the original Great Cuts series.
I love that. Yeah. I read Crucible of Chaos. I haven't got to replay of Shadows yet, but I was telling MJ, cause you read Malevolent 7.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I love the ways in which you took what you've written in the past. And this is the best thing about like an interconnected fictional universe and something that like I really aspire to as well with my Fungalverse and all the books that I want to have take place over different time periods and feature sort of like nods to things that came in the past, but also like building out the complexity of the world while also giving each series its sort of like individuality, I think is a really impressive feat and something that gives a world like this much more depth, but also keeps it more engaging because you're not just like, you know, it's a retread of what came before or anything like that. I think like Joe Abercrombie did this well with his books, even though there are characters as like literally the child of the person that came from the series before. But to be able to flesh out a world like this is really impressive. Even if you did it for money, I don't really care.
I'm mostly kidding about the money.
Yeah.
No, the
it's all for personal satisfaction.
It's to give back to the kids. I think the trick to it all is for those who are listening who are writing and sort of envision big universes and things like that, is you still have to find a way to tell one story at a time. And you have to just be so true to that story that it's as if none of the other books would ever matter. Like they don't exist when you're writing it. And so, you know, that's always the most important challenge. It's one of the reasons why I say, like, I start from character, because character is your lens on what's going on. And you don't want, and we all sometimes read those sort of fantasy or science fiction novels where a character is like artificially telling you stuff about people that aren't them, that is like, it's something you kind of want to feed in, but it's not actually part of their experience. And you have to really resist that temptation and just go back to, no, there's only one story, right? It's the story of that character. And while you're telling that story, nothing else exists.
Right. Because you're breaking the illusion and you're being author instead of inhabiting the character. It's like, oh, this piece of information needs to be conveyed.
Yeah.
But is that the right person to convey it? Or would they believably be the one to know about it or to discuss it? All right, buddy. Well, we will wrap it up there, but I have two requests from you. First, if you could give listeners and viewers a good bit of soundbite writing advice, and then tell us a weird or random fact that you find to be utterly fascinating.
Sure. So the best writing advice I know of, the classic writing advice everyone hears is write the story you most want to read. But I would add to that, my augmentation is write the story you most want to read boldly. And what I mean by that is that when newer writers are trying to write their novels, the biggest mistake that I see people make is they get gun shy of not being original enough. And so they really love Twilight, but they know that everyone's kind of sick of Twilight, you know, so they're like, well, I better not make the vampires as sparkly. You know, I won't make them as noble. I won't make this character, you know, so they start to take away the things that they themselves love, you know, and that's a terrible mistake. You need to write incredibly boldly because we already have all of these wonderful books originally. So you writing a toned down version of what you love doesn't work. It's better to, I remember when I was taking acting lessons once, I was like the world's third worst professional actor. And I remember this guy saying, no, just always go way too big. Cause a director can rein you in, but it's very hard for them to push you out. So like your first response should be, and that's what it is. Like when you're writing for, you know, when you're sitting down to write that opening chapter, go nuts. Like just go, like if your characters, if you just love the noble, heroic farm boy character, just write that and write it like more noble, more farm boy than Luke Skywalker ever was, right? Because chances that are that
Thor.
Yeah. Well, chances are that's how you're going to find something really good. But if you just keep watering things down because you think that that's going to hide a lack of originality, it doesn't. It just kills the spark. So that's my piece of writing advice.
Love it.
Weird random fact. I don't have one because my whole existence is spent as a writer asking, why do we have this weird cultural phenomenon but not this other one? So a good example of that is, when you sit at a bistro or an outdoor cafe in Paris or other big cities in France, you're sometimes sitting there and you'll see people come by, selling flowers and, trying to sell roses and stuff. And I was like, that's kind of a weird thing. How come we have that, but we don't have salt girls, which is a terrible, but I was like, why is it we don't have these beautiful, women and men who walk around with these trays with these exotic salts that you can buy from them, that probably don't taste very different, but it just feels so cool to get like this interesting kind of salt. And, you pay like a euro for this, really, and they tell you, no, this salt works like this. And, why don't we have that? Why do we have cigarette girls, but not that? When people go like, where do you get your ideas from? A lot of the time it's looking for weird facts that don't exist. So my weird fact is actually that I go through life going, and that's what happened when I was thinking about all the weird beliefs that we have about spirituality in certain arenas or celebrities. And I went, how come we've never had like a weird sort of superstition that truly great actors on stage actually channel the spirits of the hero of the historical figures they play? Cause I fight there. I did the fight choreography for a production of Richard III in London, like 20 years ago. And it was a production that was aiming to be more historically accurate than the typical portrayal where he's like this weird villain, which is also part of what informed Play of Shadows. I just had that, how come we don't have that belief that when like a truly great actor takes the stage, that they're channeling the real spirit and that you're actually seeing Richard III is really there. That's my thing.
I like it though.
That's awesome.
It's questioning reality and the weirdness of reality in order to fuel your imagination.
Exactly. We may or may not live in a multiverse, but why not pretend and ask what's in the what's in those other universes?
Every fiction book out there is another window into the multiverse.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Sebastian, thank you so much for chatting with MJ and I today. And if you could please let everyone know where they can find you online.
Yes. Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me.
Pleasure.
Especially MJ, because I know if it was up to Adrian, I would never be here.
You're welcome. I got you.
This is the Found Family banter that we've all been waiting for.
That's right. And the best place to find me is at decastell.com. That's DECASTELL.com. You can, if you want to, that's where you'll find everything that's going on that's new with me. And if you want to chat, talk to me, you can go to the contact page. I answer every email. I'm much more unreliable on social media because I find the less I'm on it, the happier I am. So, but I love getting letters and emails. Mm-hmm. I get them every day and I reply to all of them.
Amazing. And also go pick up Sebastian's books. You got plenty to choose from, but if you want the newest, go get Play of Shadows. You can also enjoy Crucible of Chaos, which is a prelude to that.
Play of Shadows is out today when this airs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's out a little bit before in the UK.
Okay.
Just because, I don't even understand like UK versus US publishing dates. But anyways, it's out now or very soon. So go enjoy it. And then go look at Sebastian's wall for a wide selection, a wide bevy of fantastic fiction.
Right.
You can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram, Twitter, Threads, all that stuff at SFF Addicts Pod. You can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. You can find my book on Amazon. You can get it in paperback, hardcover, or ebook. MJ, what about you?
You can find me across all social media at MJ Kuhn Books, all one word, or just everything at mjkuhn.com. Buy my books if you want to help me feed my cat. Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. And don't forget that Adrian's book actually has every page is soaked in just a teensy bit of psilocybin. So eat the pages when you're done,
actually, and you'll have a really great time. One page per every book has that.
Please fingers as you turn, as you turn the pages. Like an old granny.
You'll have those pages. Best experience.
You spoil it, Sebastian. Now everybody knows. My dosing of the public is...
I tried to, when Saint's Blood was coming out, I tried to convince Quercus, my publisher. I said, let me just give a pint of blood and they can pour it into the ink at the printer.
That is meta.
Every book would have a little bit of my blood in it. And they thought that was a terrible idea. And I still don't know why, but they'll continue to reassure me that it is a terrible idea.
They're like, your book would be a biohazard, but that's fine.
That'd be a bad way to find out you had typhoid.
Jesus Christ. We traced it back to Sebastian de Castell's books.
Patient Zero.
Patient Zero. Oh my God. All right. Well, that is it for this episode. Stay tuned next week for part two with Sebastian for a mini masterclass on swashbuckling fantasy. Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.